Thank you very much. I'm just sorry that my wife wasn't here to hear that introduction. She wouldn't have believed it. A specter is haunting America, the specter of conservatism. All the powers of the old America have entered into a holy alliance to exorcise this specter. Liberals and progressives, old leftists and new leftists, radicals and populists. Of course, this is a paraphrase of the Communist Manifesto. This, of course, was not supposed to happen. According to the dominant school of American historiography, the school embodied in Lewis Hart, Arthur Schlesinger Jr., and Alan Gutman, liberalism was supposedly the only legitimate American intellectual tradition, since America lacked the feudal, class-ridden society necessary for conservatism to take root. For American liberals, the paradox of American conservatism was that the only thing conservatism had to conserve was the liberal tradition. The belief that conservative ideas had a place in American life was viewed as bizarre, while a conservative American intellectual was, by definition, an oxymoron. From this perspective, conservatism was an un-American activity. Ralph Waldo Emerson's 1841 essay entitled The Conservative was seemingly the last word on the nature of American conservatism. For Emerson, there was, quote, always a certain meanness in the argument of conservatism. It makes no poetry, breathes no prayer, has no invention, it is all memory, it degrades whatever it touches. The extent to which Americanism and liberalism had been fused was illustrated by the refusal of even a Robert A. Taft to identify himself as a conservative, preferring to call himself a liberal. Admittedly, there were conservatives, but these were simply defenders of big business and white supremacy and did not have to be taken intellectually serious. Undoubtedly, the most famous recent explication of the role of conservative ideas in American culture was Lionel Trilling's introduction to his 1958 collection of essays appropriately entitled The Liberal Imagination. Trilling, who two decades later would be recognized as a formative figure in the emergence of neoconservatism, said the following. In the United States at this time, liberalism is not only the dominant, but even the sole intellectual tradition. For it is the plain fact that nowadays there are no conservative or reactionary ideas in general circulation. This does not mean there is no impulse to conservatism or to reaction. Such impulses are certainly very strong, perhaps even stronger than most of us know, but the conservative impulse and the reactionary impulse do not, with some isolated and some ecclesiastical exceptions, express themselves in ideas, but only in action or in irritable mental gestures which seek to resemble ideas. These words were written 5 years after the publication of Friedrich von Hayek's Road to Serfdom, 1 year after Richard Weaver's Ideas Have Consequences, the same year as Peter Viereck's Conservatism Revisited and T.S. Eliot's Notes Toward the Definition of Culture, 1 year before Louis Strauss's Natural Right and History, 2 years before Francis G. Wilson's The Case for Conservatism and Hannah Arendt's The Origins of Totalitarianism, 3 years before Bernard I. Bell's Crowd Culture and Eric Voegelin's The New Science of Politics, 4 years before Russell Kirk's The Conservative Mind and Robert A. Nisbet's The Quest for Community, 5 years before John Hollowell's The Moral Foundation of Democracy, and 6 years before Walter Lippmann's The Public Philosophy. It was symptomatic that even as perceptive an observer as Trilling, writing in the very midst of the post-war revival of conservative ideas, believed the only meaningful debate among American intellectuals must take place within the American left. By the time of his death in the early 1970s, Trilling would not and could not have argued in this way. Ironic indeed did John Stuart Mill's description of conservatives as the, quote, stupid party appear in the 1970s. A decade in which conservative ideas were in the saddle and conservative intellectuals had established the agenda of public discourse. A growing national consensus emerged in the need to cut back taxes and the growth of government, to rethink the social policies of the 1960s, to lift the burdensome restrictions on property and enterprise, and to revise the liberal conventional wisdom on such matters as education and welfare. Such was the power of conservative ideas that even charter members of the American liberal establishment were reluctant to be identified as liberals. Both George McGovern and Walter Mondale preferred to be called progressives. And in McGovern's case, there was a certain justice in this because of his involvement in the Henry Wallace movement of 1948. These temporary disguises did not prevent these erstwhile liberals from suffering two of the most humiliating defeats in American presidential history. The ultimate tribute to the power of conservative ideas was, of course, the 1980 election, one of the most ideological in recent memory. The election of a president who identified closely with conservative ideas could not have occurred without the emergence of a conservative ideological opposition. This included the founding of such conservative magazines as Modern Age, National Review, and the American Spectator, the change in orientation of Commentary and Counter and other journals, the establishment of the Heritage Foundation, the American Enterprise Institute, and other conservative think tanks, the founding of the Conservative Book Club, the creating of such organizations as the Philadelphia Society, the work of the Intercollegiate Studies Institute, and the enlargement of the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal. In this case, at least, Richard Weaver was certainly correct in arguing that ideas certainly do have consequences. The other side of the coin was the eclipse of radicalism and liberalism as viable intellectual alternatives. As Daniel Bell, a self-proclaimed socialist, noted recently, in fact last year, that, quote, "The death of socialism is the most tragic political fact of the 20th century, and those who still mouth phrases about strategies for revolutionary change rarely, if ever, match that utopian idea with the brutal consequences that have followed everywhere in its wake. The left has been reduced to defending its redoubts, unable to advance and conquer new ground, or to do other than to respond to conservative intellectual initiatives. Former leftist intellectuals and politicians now vie with one another in preempting conservative ideas. Thus, we see liberal politicians sponsoring tax reduction measures, the New Republic warning us of the Soviet threat, and Ted Kennedy leading the campaign to liberate important sectors of the economy from government regulation." Ironically, at a time when conservative ideas are seemingly in the ascendancy, conservative intellectuals are engulfed by self-doubt, pessimism, and discord. A recent symposium in the Intercollegiate Review on the, quote, state of conservatism drew attention to the state of malaise and a sense of demoralization and discouragement among conservative intellectuals. What particularly distressed the contributors to the symposium, Gregory Wolfe, Clyde Wilson, George Carey, Melvin Bradford, Paul Gottfried, George Panikas, was their belief that in the eyes of the general public, and even of many conservatives, a group of former liberals now known as neoconservatives had supplanted traditional conservatives as the voice of authentic conservatism. As Clyde Wilson contended, these refugees now speak in our name, but the language they speak is the same they have always spoke. We have grown familiar with it, we learned to tolerate it, but it is tolerable only by contrast to the harsh syllables of the barbarians over the border. It contains no words for the things that we value. Our estate has been taken over by an imposter, just as we're about to inherit. Conservatives must be determined not to be taken in by any interloper, no matter how plausible, finally turned out, and full of seductive promises. Mel Bradford agreed. Our first priority is to refuse firmly and vigorously to surrender our hard-won identity to those who would use it as a cloak for policies contrary to what we intend. Lines of demarcation must be drawn, and swiftly. Panikas protested against what he called a sham conservatism, which merely temporalizes and trivializes and dissimulates spiritual laws and truths. Such a conservatism belongs almost exclusively to the world and is impervious to the primacy of God as the measure of the soul. Panikas called for an unconditional conservatism, lean, ascetical, disciplined, prophetic, unswerving in its censorial task, strenuous in its mission, strong in its faith, faithful in its dogma, pure in its metaphysic. Those are his words, not mine. These disaffected conservatives seem oblivious to the fact that diversity is a sign of vitality for any movement. Thus, Christianity spawned heresies during its period of greatest strength. Uniformity, on the other hand, indicates that a movement is no longer able to evoke passionate responses. Furthermore, observers of contemporary conservatism should not take literally the laments of conservatives regarding its future. Sociological studies of the American military during World War II noted that there usually was a correlation between the morale of a military unit and how much bitching it exhibited. Not all prominent conservative intellectuals favor purging all those except true believers. As Robert A. Nisbet recently noted, quote, "There are no guillotines in sight on the Mall, but no Jacobin ever hissed hypocrite more malevolently than so-called hardliners have at suspected pragmatists these last few years." Nisbet's warnings appropriately appeared in The Public Interest, the house organ of neoconservatism. Similarly, Russell Kirk cautioned against heresy hunting within conservatism. He noted, quote, "The existence of various factions within the conservative movement ought not to alarm us overmuch. Various emphases upon this or that aspect of public policy will remain among the several conservative groupings, but enough common ground can be cultivated to maintain a useful unity on certain large questions, supposing we abjure narrow ideology and condescend to think." What conservatism certainly didn't need was something similar to the continual sectarian quarrels which has marked the American left. Kirk's advice concluded the Intercollegiate Review Symposium. Now, the emergence of neoconservatism had been predicted by Jeffrey Hart in his 1966 book, The American Dissent. writing during the social and economic, social and intellectual disillusion stemming from the Vietnam War and the rise of the New Left, Hart foresaw that under the pressure of the world revolution, as contradictions and evasions are exposed to an ever greater extent, liberalism will certainly undergo fragmentation. Many liberals will move to the left, jettisoning their remaining Western cultural attachments. Others, just as inevitably, will move to the right, becoming more conservative. The process anticipated by Hart had already begun. The first issue of The Public Interest, edited by Daniel Bell and Irving Kristol, had appeared in 1965. The Public Interest's healthy skepticism towards social reform and his distrust of political bureaucracy struck a discordant note in the mid-1960s, coming as it did at the zenith of the Great Society. Also within a short time, commentary was to undergo that metamorphosis which transformed it into perhaps America's leading and most eloquent opponent of what Trilling had termed the adversary culture. The neoconservatives were, Norman Paul Horowitz recounted, united in opposition to the, quote, the armies of the alienated. Despite the widespread use of the term neoconservative, very few of the supposed neoconservatives, including Podhoretz, identified them such, and the word itself was coined as a mark of opprobrium by the socialist Michael Harrington. Irving Kristol was one of the few who openly admitted to being a neoconservative and almost by default became the movement's guru. His 1983 volume, Reflections of a Neoconservative, is the nearest thing to an apologetic that we have. It also reveals why some conservative devotees have reacted so negatively to neoconservatism. Neoconservatism, Kristol maintained, was a syncretic intellectual movement combining elements of classical economics and pre-capitalist moral and philosophical traditions. It simultaneously supported the free market and government intervention in behalf of manners and morals, both the desire for liberty and the need for community. But neoconservatism, according to Kristol, aims at more than syncretism. It seeks a new synthesis. It has its own distinctive inclinations. One of these was an acceptance of the welfare state, which suitably purged of paternalism and statism, could bolster what Kristol called the conservative predispositions of the people. For Kristol, the essence of neoconservatism was its effort to intellectually and morally reinvigorate the heritage of 19th century liberal capitalism, to return to the original sources of liberal vision and liberal energy so as to correct the warped version of liberalism that is today's orthodoxy. Neoconservatism represented the spirit of bourgeois populism, those are his words, while the task of neoconservative intellectuals was to explain to the people why they were right and their liberal intellectual detractors were wrong. Neoconservatism's freedom from nostalgia, its willingness to play fast and loose with some of conservatism's sacred pieties, including opposition to the welfare state, its advocacy by former liberals and even Marxists, and its acceptance of the basic outlines of American political and economic development since the New Deal and prior to the Great Society, were enough to discredit it in the eyes of some conservatives. But there is more. Neoconservatism roots are essentially in the social sciences, especially sociology and economics, while traditional conservatism's roots are in the humanities, political philosophy, theology, history, and literature. Neoconservatives seek to make government more cost-effective. Traditional conservatives are concerned with the nature of government and the meaning of a constitution. The writings of the neoconservatives are heavily factual, dependent upon the latest findings in social sciences, and concerned with what can be. Irving Kristol's famous statement is apt. A neoconservative is a liberal who has been mugged by reality. Being of recent vintage, neoconservatism lacks the rich philosophical and historical background of conservatism and its unique view of human nature. Being more concerned with what ought to be than what can be, the conservatives are more philosophical and dogmatic. First principles are to be asserted, not measured. Conservatism, Mel Bradford declared, amounts to, quote, more than opportunism, pop sociology, and a series of position papers. George Panikos agreed. Endless policy reviews and policy studies in the end lack a basic apprehension of the permanent things and are responsive to the empirical ambitions that reflect the tastes and power drives of a technological Benthamite world. The theology of conservatism has been sacrificed to the new gods and the new morality of modernity. Thus, while neoconservatives and conservatives alike reject much of contemporary liberalism, neoconservatives do so because it is unworkable and counterproductive, while conservatives do so because it runs counter to what they perceive to be human nature. The contrast between conservatism and traditional conservatism is clearly revealed in their in the different attitudes toward religion. For neoconservatives, religion is necessary for social stability, while traditional conservatives are concerned with man's relationship to God. Neoconservatives are extremely sympathetic toward religion as an institution, but in contrast to traditional conservatives, they generally do not concern themselves with the truths of religion and are not known generally for being religious themselves. Much of the discontent of the old right regarding the status of conservatism involves its supposed secularization under the impact of neoconservatism. We cannot escape the fact, Panikus contended, that during the past 10 years or so, conservatism has experienced a spiritual decline, even as it has made considerable political gains. And yet, despite the differences between the neoconservatives and traditional conservatives, they have much in common. Both distrust social engineering and deracinated intellectuals. Both support the widespread distribution of private property and free enterprise. Both accept traditional morality, and both strongly identify with the West in general and the United States in particular. Their most important point of agreement concerns the encroachment of the state on the private sector. The origins of conservatism are to be found in the protest of Edmund Burke and the French opponents of the Revolution against the aggrandizement of public power at the expense of the private sector. In defending Burke's little platoons and the prerogatives of church, family, and profession, conservatives saw as their task the protection of private social authority against the assaults of public political authority. Today, neoconservatives are skeptical as to the benefits of centralized economic planning, while traditional conservatives dread the encroaching state. The neoconservative view of the state was shaped by the events of the 1960s, while that of the conservatives was a product of a philosophical, historical, and literary tradition which emphasized the need for roots and community. Southern conservatives have, of course, an additional reason for fearing centralized power. But what is important is not that the fears of neoconservatives and conservatives regarding centralized government is derived from different sources, but rather that they lead to similar conclusions, namely the danger of the state. The major issue facing the contemporary right is the same one which faced Burke, the threat posed to the family, local social institutions, and private economic organizations from the aggrandizement of political authority. Conservative purists can debate the question whether the government should have become involved in education, housing, and public welfare, but in view of the strength of statism, it is certainly counterproductive to spurn support for neoconservatives. No one is without sin or beyond redemption, particularly anti-collectivists. The greatest student of America also wrote the greatest conservative commentary on American life, and I refer, of course, to Alexis de Tocqueville and his great book, Democracy in America. Tocqueville both feared and admired American democracy. His fears stemmed from the recognition that democracy was a transnational phenomenon and that, in certain respects, America resembled post-revolutionary France. In both countries, standardization, egalitarianism, and materialism held sway. In democracies, the passion for equality, he wrote, is ardent, insatiable, eternal, and invincible. Democracies will put up with poverty, servitude, and barbarism, but they will not endure aristocracy. Tocqueville's admiration for America stemmed from the realization that American society was free of some of the more unfortunate aspects of mass democracy it exhibited in France, particularly the political centralization, which he underscored in his other great book, The Old Regime and the French Revolution. He emphasized the decentralized character of America, her numerous churches, powerful local governmental bodies, vigorous private economic life, influential legal establishment, he called, by the way, the American bar the only counterbalance to democracy in America, and above all, the private organizations he called associations. The essence of modern liberalism is the defense of the Leviathan state, while in contrast, Tocqueville's fears of centralized political authority resonate among conservatives of every variety. Whether opposition to the liberal state is derived from philosophical, historical sources or from the social sciences is less important than the opposition itself. As heirs of de Tocqueville's intellectual legacy, conservatives and neoconservatives are natural allies and not foes.